So first, let me thank Mag, Doug, and Eduardo for inviting me to come out here. It's definitely always a great experience to be at KITP, and also for giving me the opportunity to present this work here. So the title of this presentation is a question. Ask tribes the key to the puzzles of thermal and electrical transport in undoped cuprates. And as you know, when a paper begins with a title which is a question, the body of the paper always answers affirmatively. So keeping in line with this tradition, so here also I'm expressing a bias. However, we don't really have a paper, so in this sense it's less imposing. And in fact,
it's still being published on the web, so.
We'll see. No. So actually, the intent of this talk is really to present some ideas that we've been musing about with Christos Panagopoulos, many of you know, thinking about various experiments in the underdoped cuprates, but also more in the optimal doped ones. And so really what I'm trying to extract from this talk, which is self-serving, really is for you to either shoot down those ideas or maybe to come up with your own explanations to some of the experiments that I'm going to show you. So my collaborator, Chris Panagopoulos, he is now sort of bifurcating between University of Crete and Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. And so here are his funding sources, the European Excellence Grant from European Science Foundation, and this is my funding, LGRD from DOE. Okay, obviously there are many more puzzles than one can even enumerate in the cuprate. But here I would like to focus on some of them, which at least I found really striking and really puzzling. And so the first part has to do with the normal transport, and in particular normal transport in highly underdoped regime, let's say 1%, 3% doping in LSTO, so that's where mainly experiments have been done. And this is work by Panagopoulos. And more on the superconducting sides, so this puzzle you're well aware of, that there is a superconducting response above transition temperature, which is seen in the Nernst effects, which is seen in diamagnetism, and this work primarily by Fang Ong from Princeton. And also there is a lot of results from AC conductivity from Dima Basa, for instance, and also from terahertz spectroscopies by Joe Ornstein, and also more recently by Peter Armitage. And what I'll try to argue is that perhaps one way to reconcile those strange phenomena is to really introduce inhomogeneity in the system, which is not particularly dynamic, which can be actually even essentially static. And if we introduce this ingredient, then a lot of those phenomena may find an explanation. So let's start with the normal. And I'll be showing a bunch of data, and if it looks confusing, just ask me, because I think I roughly understand what it corresponds to. So these are experiments on 3% strontium-doped LCO. And what is shown here is the magnetic resistance, resistivity as a function of magnetic field, and also various noise curves. So let's start with this one. So what we see here is actually something quite striking. Starting from zero magnetic field, resistivity grows linearly. Okay. And this is in clear violation of Fonsager relationships. It doesn't really, it's not supposed to behave like this. Resistivity should be time reversal invariant. Moreover, if you sweep up in field and then you sweep down, so let's say here the trace is, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, we see hysteresis. And so there is an obvious hysteresis going, say, from 1 to 2, but also one can study in a bit more detail what is happening by looking at the subloops. For instance, if one looks at this red subloop and the blue subloop. And in hysteretic phenomena, it's actually known that there is a lot of significance to congruence or non-congruence of the loops. That puts certain limits on the theories. of the fluctuators which are involved in the static behavior. Okay, so that's one. So also, what actually shows quite clearly, there are some sort of two-level systems which are involved in the dynamics of the system, is basically just a time trace of resistivity. So resistivity is a function of time at various temperatures. And we see that as we go to lower temperatures, but essentially anywhere below half a degree, you see some sort of switching behavior, okay? Some kind of fluctuators coming in and out, which indicates that there are some weak links which come in and out of existence and which can significantly affect the behavior of the sample. So the scale here is few percent, but obviously there is not enough self-averaging even in this effectively macroscopic sample, and we see those features. Okay. So continuing with the same system, just to pinpoint in a bit more detail what is happening with this hysteretic behavior. What is shown here is the resistivity as a function of basically a protocol in a magnetic field. So one starts from zero magnetic field, then ramps it up to one Tesla, then goes down to zero, then ramps it up to 2, 0, 4, 0, 5, 0, 8, 0. And as you see, resistivity goes up in the applied magnetic field, but then when the field it drops back to zero, in fact, resistivity doesn't go back to its original reference value. Okay, it keeps going up under this kind of protocol. On the other hand, if one...
Well, that's because you're not reversing the field, right?
Yeah, so here you don't reverse it, yeah.
Yeah, that's what
I'm saying. Yeah, that's right. And so then if we... And in fact, I mean, there are also various issues with regards to whether you filled cool, et cetera, so where you start from, et cetera, et cetera. So here's another protocol. So here we start from, let's say, 0, go up to 6, then go only up to 1, and then 2. And then you see that really what matters is the highest field that you've reached, so which is quite canonical behavior in ferromagnets. Okay. So, but I remind you that this is really just the same sort of 3% Doptelis zero that Bergeron and company have been doing neutron scattering on, which is supposed to be antiferromagnetic, okay, or at best some kind of modulated antiferromagnet. So this is a bit more of the related data. So this is resistivity in the AB plane, just to show that behavior doesn't really depend too much on the orientation of the field and the direction in which one measures resistivity. So again, in this plot, what we have is temperature, a magnetic field. So one can look essentially at those slices. So for instance, this line is measurements, I guess, like at half a degree, and resistivity as a function of magnetic field goes up. We have significant positive magnetic resistance, which is linear at small fields. And then as we increase temperature, as we go above half a degree, then the positive magnetic resistance disappears, and we just have negative magnetic resistance. And so these are some of the hysteretic curves. So at high temperature, the region of positive magnetic resistance is more narrow. It's only up to 4 Tesla, and then it's replaced by a negative magnetic resistance, differential magnetic resistance. But then if you start reversing the field, you peel off and you observe significant hysteresis again. And at 0.2 degrees, and this range of positive magnetic resistance is much broader, and the hysteresis seems to be peeling off in a different way. So that's really bizarre. So what are the possible explanations? In fact, there aren't too many. And so the only paper that I know about is the one by Erica Carlson, Karen Damon, Eduardo Fradkin, and Steve Kibbleson. And what they propose is to consider a model which contains domains of stripes, and under application of magnetic field, those domains can reorient. So for instance, if we apply a certain magnetic field, it will favor one orientation of the stripes, and then this thing will become much more sort of symmetric, or at least pneumatic, and that should lead to significant anisotropy in transport, but also may lead to different resistivity altogether. And to model the system, they basically mapped it onto a random resistor network.
Excuse me, but this is for
the copper oxide?
Oxygen planes?
Yes.
So you'd expect reorientation for a field in the AB plane, but what about in the seed graph?
Precisely. Yeah, so that's the point that I wanted to raise. And in fact, there's a related issue that even if it's a diamagnetic reorientation, because I mean, so transport obviously is different if you apply a field like this or apply a field along the stripes. But nevertheless, the effect shouldn't really depend on the direction of the field, which means it should be quadratic in magnetic field. So,
are you bringing us some straw man here? Because I mean, from what you just showed us experimentally, I wouldn't see any obvious reason to start talking about stripes.
Okay. Yeah.
Magnetism.
But then the question you have to answer is, where does this magnetism is coming from, right? And in fact, we'll get to that in the next slide. Because the issue is that if it's really an antiferromagnet, I mean, this thing shouldn't really couple to magnetic field at all, right? Or perhaps in some quadratic order in magnetic field, right? So as far as this particular work is concerned,
maybe. But you know, once you start invoking disorder, imagine some little. I mean, just phenomenologically, it seems like a strange point to jump to.
Okay. So at this point, I'm basically just telling you the only work that I know of which addresses the problem, and that's by Erika and company. But other than that, and that's precisely the point of this talk. And maybe there is a better explanation, a simple explanation. And maybe it's lurking around, it's just nobody, you know, said it yet. And you're welcome to be the first. But so that's the deal. So that's as much as we have right now in the market, at least as far as I know. And indeed, the issues with this picture are that this pattern is not really supposed to couple to magnetic field, which is out of the plane. But nevertheless, there is significant effect seen under application of the field out of the plane. And also, so the other issues are that flipping of the domain walls, I mean, flipping of those big domains should be actually quite costly. Large free energy barriers, and therefore, doesn't seem to be extremely likely. And finally, if one really takes seriously that the stripes are supposed to be anti-phase domain walls in antiferromagnets, you're not really supposed to have any loose ends like that, because then antiferromagnets are supposed to change sign as you go around. So it's kind of, I mean, there are several difficulties. So, and the main difficulty indeed is, how can one couple antiferromagnet to magnetic field? Because we know that the system is by and large antiferromagnetic. Okay. So, and here's what seems to be the possible answer. If we look at LSCO, it's not a perfect cubic crystal, but rather it has orthorhombic distortion, particularly at those dopings, at low dopings. And under orthorhombic distortion, what happens is that because of spin-orbit interaction, Zelenskiy-Murray interaction, the moments actually can't out of the plane. Okay, and so that causes basically each one of the planes, assuming uniform antiferromagnetism and the uniform pattern of distortions, to become weakly ferromagnetic. And this is actually known experimentally. So that's the work from 1988 by Theo et al., where indeed what has been seen is the reorientation transition under application of the field in the C direction, and actually not only in the C direction, that the planes can get locked in. So basically, the canonical antiferromagnetic order in those kind of cuprates is basically have a sign change between different adjacent planes. But under application of magnetic field, in fact, there is a transition under which all the planes become equivalent. Okay, and that's these data. Okay, so there is a bit of ferromagnetism here, but let me remind you that the canting angle is really tiny. It's like a degree or maybe even less. And as a result, the ferromagnetic moment, which is associated with, if you count the ferromagnetic moment per copper atom, it's going to be something like 10 to minus 3 Bohr magnetons. So it's really small. Okay, so. And that's as much sort of play we can get out of this ferromagnet. So each moment has just a little bit of ferromagnetism associated with it. And so there in the experiments, magnetic resistance experiment that I showed you, the fields which were being implied, they were on the order of a Tesla, a few Tesla. So which means that it cannot be a single moment physics, since multiplying a few Teslas by 10 to minus 3 Bohr magnetons, we end up with some millikelvins, which is much smaller temperatures than what is observed experimentally, where all this interesting behavior is observed. Okay? So, but okay, so the point of this slide is that there is a way to couple antiferromagnet to magnetic field. So now let me draw sort of an elaborate strawman picture, so to speak, how things can happen, in my opinion. And you're free to shoot it down, or again, I'll come up with a better one. So the story is this. So these thick black lines will correspond to charge stripes. Okay. And these are canonical charge stripes, a la Zanon, Machida, etc., which correspond to a sign change across the domain wall. So essentially, this antiferromagnet and this antiferromagnet, they're different in sign. And what that means is that the weak ferromagnetism, which corresponds to this domain, is going to be opposite in sign to weak ferromagnetism, which is associated with this domain. Okay. And so as you notice, this kind of mixture, I mean, it's obviously quite perfect. It corresponds to a 50-50 composition of one antiferromagnet versus the other antiferromagnet. Okay? But now, each one of those little guys...
again, you're talking about ferromagnetism in the C direction.
Yes. Yeah. So in principle, it's not so dramatic. I mean, it's not extremely significant whether you're applying field in the C direction or in AB direction, because you still can reorient moments because spin orbits are not too strong. Okay. So what is this grid? This grid actually is not—it's definitely not a copper lattice. So what it is basically some super lattice which has distances on the order of the interstripe distance. And this is the cell which goes as notorious 1 over 2x. Okay. So let's say at 12% doping, it will be 4 lattices. Or 4 unit cells, and let's say at 3% doping, it will be more like 16. So those things really, really grow. So now if we think about what kind of possible moves are allowed, so how can we rearrange this perfect pattern into something more disordered? The constraints that we have to impose is that the overall charge density shouldn't really change. So what it means is that, for example, these horizontal lines we can flip into vertical lines, but to do anything more dramatic would cost us quite a bit more energy. Okay, so that's the assumption that we make, that those charge stripes, they do want to preserve their identity because of some stronger coupling physics. Okay, so but this kind of flips, as I said, there are lots. So essentially, we took this domain, we flip it into the other one, so that's perfectly fine. But now notice that application of a magnetic field, let's say, which favors the orange domains, will tend to generate this kind of defect, particularly if there is disorder which sort of already puts this kind of configurations, whether this one or that one, in near degeneracy. Okay? And the macroscopic moment which corresponds to this reorientation goes with the area of this plaquette, and for instance, at 3% doping, the moment is actually quite reasonable. It's on the order of half Bohr magneton. So if we multiply it by a reasonable field of a few Tesla, we do get a reasonable temperature of about half a degree or 1 degree, which is consistent with this experiment. Moreover, if you apply really strong fields, there's even a possibility which has been entertained by Ando based on his experiments that the system can get totally reoriented into single domain antiferromagnets, but still with some kind of stripy inhomogeneities. Okay, but this is supposedly not the lowest energy state. Okay. So let's take this as a cartoon picture, and now let's think what would be the consequences. So each one of those regions which is susceptible to flipping because of disorder, which can be either chemical or it can be because of the way the thing sort of quenched, corresponds to this kind of two-state system. So I can either have this kind of configuration or that kind of flip configuration which keeps overall neutral charge density, assuming uniform charge density along the stripes. So basically, I'm not doing anything to the total length of this pattern. And so now this fluctuator can be modeled in this canonical way, a la Varma, Anderson, Halperin, as a two-well potential in some sort of configuration coordinate. And so one configuration will have one particular energy, and the other configuration will have another energy. But they will couple differently to magnetic field. So magnetic field can tilt this pattern. And the other letters here are H is whatever, let's say, crystalline anisotropy we have in the system, because of, let's say, tetragonal distortion, one kind of stripes will be favored over the other kind of stripes, something like this. And Xi is an actual random field which comes from various sorts of disorder, okay? So now, if those fluctuators are basically located at far enough distances from each other, then we don't really need to worry about their interactions, and so we end up with what's known as a Kreyszag model, where all the fluctuators, they do their own thing, and then actually for this particular model, a lot of things are known about the hysteretic behavior, about this congruency of the subloops, etc., etc. And so again, if we assume this independence, then we can immediately calculate very easily the magnetization as a function of magnetic field. And we find that it is linear in magnetic field, and the temperature doesn't enter if the temperature is low enough compared to the typical barrier height. Okay, so that's significant. So we can have basically stability in the system, which at low fields is constant. So we get magnetization which is linear in B. Okay, and so here's this elaborate animation that I created. So essentially, that's the kind of processes that we are considering. But they're not supposed to flip all at the same time. They can flip at all kinds of different random times. And indeed, if we look at the experimental data, there is evidence for this kind of hysteretic behavior, even at quite high temperatures. So this is data from Christos from 2006, where he measured weak ferromagnetic behavior at fairly high temperatures. And this is 15% doped single crystal LSCO. So indeed, we see this kind of nice, weak hysteretic behavior. Okay. So what other consequences can we extract from this fluctuator model? For one thing, we can expect that something interesting will happen when the magnetic field times the magnetization of single domain becomes comparable to KT. So at this point, we can start running into hysteresis, right? Because at this point, the effects of the magnetic fields will be bigger than the effects of thermal fluctuations. So we'll be able to drive system into the states which were not accessible through thermal fluctuations. Okay. So also, like in all those two-level situations, one can expect to get one of ref noise from the sort of standard consideration of Dutein-Horn. But also what's interesting is that by analyzing the shape of those hysteretic loops and subloops, one can figure out whether indeed those fluctuators are interacting or not. So for instance, if the loops are congruent, that corresponds to this Kreyszag model, which is a good indication that the fluctuators are really weakly interacting. Okay, and if they're not, they're not. Now, what's curious is that if we look at the resistivity and resistivity, the loops are actually non-congruent. Okay, which indicates interaction. However, if we look at magnetization, so this is the plots unpublished, which I asked Chris to produce, and what this one is supposed to indicate, although I'm not exactly sure how to read it, is that in magnetization there is indeed not too much incongruency, so the loops actually very similar. Okay. And so magnetization basically tells us that this non-interacting fluctuator model seems to work fine. So why does resistivity behave differently? So in fact, that's not so surprising because resistivity doesn't really...
That's a measurement of the magnetization.
Yeah, it's a delta M.
What length scale?
So this is, you mean EMU or oh, that's the uniformization. So it's a small sample. I can't remember. It was some milligram type of thing. So it's 3% and 4 degrees. So the temperature is somewhat different, actually. But okay. So at first glance, it looks kind of puzzling. But then, if you think about it, it's not really so surprising because. So if we think about resistivity is really a more global property of the system. So we inject current from one side and we pick it up from the other side, and then it has to sort of navigate its way through the system. So it will be affected by the fluctuators, which are located actually quite big distances apart, right? Despite the fact that when these guys are flipping, they might not seem to care about each other at all. Okay. So this is the sort of random resistor network model that would correspond to the picture that I was pushing for. And so these, again, those dark black lines are thick black lines. They are the location of the stripes, which one can naturally assume they're more conductive. Okay, and those pink regions and the dashed lines, they correspond to high resistances. So it's if you really want to take electron and transfer it across an interferometric insulator, which is supposed to be tough. So essentially we have nodes, and from each node we have four resistors coming out, two large ones and two small ones. Okay. And as you see, this is actually quite a curious random resistor network, because you can sort of guess that it really matters a lot what is the volume fraction or surface fraction for one region versus the other, right? Even given the same length of those, exactly the same number of the small resistors, right? Because, so imagine that I really apply very strong magnetic field, so to speak, and I make those blue regions significantly subdominant relative to the pink regions. Then it means that I have bubbles of this blue phase in the pink phase, and then I really have to go across lots of large resistors, which will suppress my conductivity. But I might as well apply field in the opposite direction, and then the situation will repeat itself, except that the colors will be swapped. Okay. So this model is actually, if you think in terms of StatMag, it's nothing else than the six vertex model, and. It's actually quite has lots of interesting statistical mechanical properties. But so one issue is that so if we write down this kind of resistor network model, it's kind of non-trivial even to simulate it, because you have to generate the phase space with the constraint that, let's say, a fraction of one phase is different than the fraction of that phase by a certain number, so it becomes rather complicated. But some things you can guess. So let's say if we start from perfect smectic, and we dilute it with those grains of the flip domains. Okay, so the number of the flip domains are basically going to tell us what's the number of weak links that we introduce into the resistor network. Okay, so then starting from smectic, I can immediately write down what the resistivity should behave like. So I'll have, let's say, almost 10 resistors, but reduced by 1 minus p of the small resistors, and so np resistors, which are large. Okay, and all of that I normalize by n, because they're in a square, they're n overall chains. Okay, and then I get this kind of simple expression.
Right here, you add resistivity, but not conductivity, because you have parallel channels.
Yeah, so parallel channels center here, so I divide by n. Okay, but so it is a little bit artificial example. What it corresponds to is I have smectic, so basically I have perfect channels going across, but now introduce breaks, okay, which are weak links. okay? And qualitatively, it seems reasonable that, okay, so the number of the breaks will be equal to NP, so P is the probability of dilution, of deviation, right? And so that's what I got. But so this is obviously quite simplistic and not extremely practically appealing. So the other thing which I did is really just to take much more random configuration, really messed up one, and again vary the fraction of one phase versus the other. So this is again the same P, and so this is the network where the large resistor is bigger than the small resistor by factor of 100, and you get this kind of behavior. If it's 400, you get also similar behavior. So you do, although it's by far not the greatest simulation in the world, it does show that indeed P equal to zero, so essentially equal fractions of A and B are special. That's where you have highest conductivity. But if you deviate in either direction, that's when you suppress conductivity.
What did you expect as you changed hole concentration and the separation of the stripes, increase or decrease depending on which direction you're going, that you'd have a dramatic change in the ratio of the weak to the strong resistor as the separation between sides got bigger?
That's right. Yeah, I would definitely expect that, yeah.
And do you see any such systematics?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think, yeah, you do see that magnetic resistance goes up as you decrease doping, so which seems to be consistent. So if you go to higher dopings, so those effects, they seem to evaporate, to go away. Okay. So, yeah, and the point here is very simple again, so let me just mention it, that this fraction P goes with magnetization, and as we showed before, magnetization for this kind of fluctuating model scales with the magnetic field. So that's how we get resistivity or magnetic resistance, which is linear in a magnetic field. Okay. So anyway, so that was the end of the resistive part. And I don't know, if anybody has a better idea, would be really happy to hear, or at least an argument why this is all, you know, that we're fooling ourselves. And
it's linear because you have the cusp of this.
Yeah. So essentially, this is 50-50. So if you zero-filled cool, so you expect to get equal, just from statistical standpoint, equal fractions of the A antiferromagnet and B antiferromagnet. So for instance, if you measured neutron scattering, you wouldn't see anything at pi, right? You would only get something at the incremental.
If you look to the picture below, it seems quadratic.
Oh, this one, no, you shouldn't really trust it too much. So this is, okay, so this simulation on 128 by 128, and the step is not particularly good, so I don't know. I mean, so I wouldn't say, you know, bet my life on it, that it's not quadratic in some range, that it doesn't depend on some funny way on the ratio of resistances, but I'm not good enough with simulations to really tell how it goes. Because for me, really, even the problem is how to generate unbiased sample of those configurations which are allowed.
Maybe you said it, I missed it, I guess. In the picture, it looks like you're starting always from one of the two orientations of the stripes.
Not here.
Not there.
Yeah. So here, basically, what I did, I started from some kind of weird checkerboard configuration, which actually corresponds to the ratio 1:3 of the two phases. And then I can systematically increase the fraction of one relative to the other in a random fashion. And so that's how the simulation is done.
Is there some kind of correlation length for the pattern? It's just lattice scale.
No, so here there is no correlation, at least nothing that I put in. So the starting configuration is, like this. And as you can tell, it's basically 1:3, right, because I have, okay. And now I can completely safely, with certain probability, either shade or not shade at these regions. And this way, I can generate patterns which in the end, so let's say if the probability is equal to 1, and then I'm going to basically end up with the dual one, where I have bubbles of this phase, right? So it's not particularly biased, but it's not very unbiased either, so. So
just a experimental comment. I mean this is fine. I understand what you're doing. And it's neat that you get this linear thing. But going in and out of noise studies over my career, which is now getting to be fairly long, and what's actually fluctuating has never been understood because people are making bulk measurements and trying to infer back. Now, I would say because the length scale here is relatively large, it's not truly atomic, it's several unit cells, that I think it should be possible now to go in with some kind of magnetic microscope and actually see the magnetic fluctuations that you would argue have to be there as these things go up and down.
Yeah, that'd be
now really going to be self-serving. And I think there is something been known for a while, and we're beginning to really try to use it with scanning tunneling potentiometry, where you can go in with sort of atomic resolution and measure the potentials as you move around. That will pick this sort of thing up. So, I mean, I think it would be interesting to talk to people who do that kind of thing, because these bulk measurements, you just never know.
That's right.
One of our FNOIs, I mean, if you read, what's his name, Mike Weissman's review article, which is the latest one, you know, there's all these weird theories about what's, I mean, the macroscopics are well understood, they kind of, lots of things you can say, but there's been no way of getting in any particular system and actually establishing what the fluctuator is, and this has got the same problem, but I think there is hope.
Yeah, so the length scales are actually still quite tiny, right? So even if you go to 3% doping, the length scale here will be, 16 lattice constants. So is this already accessible? And also, if you're actually going to be sensitive to the ferromagnetic moment, okay, so it's half Bohr magneton, which is, I mean, it's not too small, but it's also not so huge. So.
Well, they're getting down.
Yeah, so maybe eventually it will be possible to check. But yeah, so the story here really is that it might be worth it to keep the identity of those regions. Maybe if the system really wants to be stripy, so these are the moves that it can do, right? It can basically rearrange itself in such a way that to keep the stripiness happy, right? And that's sort of, it's not extremely expensive, I mean, so you're transferring a few charges over the distances, a few lattice constants.
Do you have any, I think I know the answer, and it's not a fair question, but I mean, do you have any idea, I mean, what that ratio ought to be?
Ratio of?
The R's.
Well, actually, one can.
Does the experiment tell you how big it is?
One might try to squeeze it out, but I wouldn't be, holding my breath that it's totally doable. So to calculate the resistivity of insulator, it's easy, but of the antiferromagnets, that's, you can,
yeah.
It's tunneling, right?
I, that's what I wanted to say.
But even with these stripy things, I don't know. But you know that one has to be much bigger than the other, so that's for sure. And it should go with the doping.
The one over 2x.
Yeah, because if you're tunneling over this distance, in fact, saying with doping, it should really go exponentially if you go
well,
to.
Yeah, the resistivity sensitivity would be much stronger than inverse linear. So you separate those two stripe regions by larger and larger distance, as you say, probably something more like exponential with the distance.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the story. We're trying to put some meat on the bones, I mean, to see whether it can be invalidated in some smart way or validated, but at this point we're still struggling. So that was normal. But now what I would like to maybe if not convince, but at least suggest to you that maybe also in the superconducting fluctuations there is something going on, which possibly could be addressed also using this kind of inhomogeneities. So this is the cartoon of the Nernst effects, and you know that mystery. the Nernst effect, which is supposed to measure remnant superconductivity in the system above TC, actually disappears at very high temperatures, at temperatures which can be several times the transition temperature. So this is the data for LSTO. Again, let me just remind you how it works. So what one does, one takes a sample, applies a temperature gradient, there are vortices, and the vortices drift from hot part to the cold part. But in the process, since each one of them is carrying a magnetic flux, that generates a transverse voltage. Okay. So that's the story there. And in fact, there are measurements also by the same group which show that there is indeed also a diamagnetic response which goes along with that, and which also basically follows roughly the same curve. And the diamagnetic response is supposed to, again, measure, in a sense, the volume fraction of the superconductor in the matrix of the perhaps non-superconducting material. Okay, so this is more on the same subject. What is shown here is the superfluid stiffness as a function of temperature. And these are the data that you've probably seen quite a few times from Joe Arnstein. That's on BISCO. And these are data on LSCO. And these are the scores here of Peter Armitage. This is still unpublished data and has now lots of very high sensitivity results. So let me tell you briefly how one should look at these pictures. What one measures is the AC conductivity. And from the AC conductivity, one can extract the superfluid stiffness, so where here's basically denoted by the tau phi, which is supposed to stand for the costless tauless transition temperature. So if the conductivity went as 1 over omega, then that would be a simple superfluid response, but it turns out that there are deviations in real materials. So if it were a real costless tau superconductor, then essentially the superfluid stiffness would go like this, but then would drop precipitously. But instead, through TC, which is over here, it moves on smoothly. But in fact, at the costless tauless, or sort of putative costless tauless transition temperature, the curves which correspond to different measurement frequencies, they fan out. Okay. So this was used as an evidence for persistence of superconductivity at temperatures higher than TC. But now the subtlety is that the region of this superconducting-like response is actually much more narrow coming out from optics than from magnetization studies or from Nernst studies. And so this is the comparison for LSCO and for BISCO. So this is taken from the Joe Arnstein recent paper, and this is again comparison done by Peter Armitage. And we see the same patterns. So here, green line is the transition temperature, TC. Blue is the Nernst, red is diamagnetism, and this brown line corresponds to the upper cutoff on the AC superconducting response from conductivity. So again, this window is very narrow, and the similar pattern is seen if one looks at BISCO. Again, this region is very small, like 10, 20 degrees.
Say that again, the cross-hatch for the gray area is...
So that's the...
Where's the...
So AC is... So the conductivity is here, superfluid stiffness.
And the Nernst is
higher. Nernst is higher, yes. So this is basically the gray area where nobody knows how to think about the system.
And that was the lower line, the squares, that was done for the highest or lowest frequency that they used? Because it does depend. If you
say. Yeah, it depends to some extent. So yeah, this I don't know. This I don't know. But
I
think it's the highest.
In this situation, it it's a diffusive kind of thing. And if you go to high frequencies, it's not, you're looking so quickly that it doesn't diffuse very far. It'll look like a superfluid, whereas at lower frequencies, it won't.
That's right.
Has
that's
that
right.
All been taken out?
So as far as I understand, there is no really good model for the for taking care of that. And so the awards which are being said, so for example, this is like a review paper. They say that to take this into account, you need to have very fast diffusion constant for the vortices. But they say it in such a way that they don't really believe that, or they don't really see how it can happen. But that would sort of solve it. Yeah. Okay. So let's look at the Nernst first of all, how that works. Now that I put the aura of mystery around the experiment. So the picture for the Nernst is goes as follows. We have our sample, and let's say we're slightly above TC. So those green patches are supposed to correspond to superconducting regions, and the black lines correspond to the heat current. And those vortices, they basically follow, they're supposed to carry the heat. Okay, so now the deal is that since we have lots of those superconducting patches, the vortices cross them once in a while, that generates a voltage pulse, and that's basically what's measured as a Nernst signal. But now let's say we go to higher temperatures. So at higher temperatures, one actually expects that those patches get smaller, or one way to think about it is the coherence length gets shorter. Then there is a problem. The problem is that if we really take at the face value this kind of picture, that we have basically just regions of superconducting sort of grains in the overall non-superconducting matrix, it's really hard to imagine why vortices would want still to go through those superconducting regions. Because it costs energy, right? If you want to put a vortex core into a superconductor, that costs energy. Also, the currents cost energy. So it's really unlikely. So in fact, it seems to be much more likely that the heat current will just go around those superconducting regions and the Nernst will drop precipitously. Okay. And magnetization, it does show that there are superconducting regions. So, and in fact, so we do see that both magnetization and Nernst, they disappear at the same temperature. Okay. So it seems that the volume fraction of superconductor is shrinking, which shows in the magnetization, but nevertheless...
Magnetization is diamagnetism.
Diamagnetism, yes. Yes. So the volume fraction of those superconducting regions is shrinking, but nevertheless, Nernst somehow is not really that dramatically affected by it. So how can it be? So why this picture breaks down? Why heat current cannot avoid those superconducting regions? And so one possibility is as follows, that perhaps we can keep the same volume fraction of superconductor, but make it much more, much higher aspect ratio. And in this case, you can tell that the heat flow cannot really very easily avoid those superconducting regions. I mean, it can, but it will perhaps also cost quite a bit. So if you get this kind of extended superconducting regions in the problem, then it's quite natural that once in a while there will be actually phase flips occurring across those superconducting stripes. Okay? And then that's basically what we like, because we know that the phase flips will generate voltage pulses. Okay. So is there any evidence for, or is there any reason to believe that something like this may be happening? Indeed, there is. So these are the famous data from a couple of years back from Chankwada and company, where they measured 12.5% barium doped LCO, and they saw that the resistivity has sort of this kind of strange transition at a fairly high temperature, which looks like superconducting transition, except that resistivity doesn't drop all the way to zero. So it still hangs on for quite some time and then goes to zero at much lower temperatures. Okay. And this was taken as an evidence of two-dimensional superconductivity. And the only reason that two-dimensional superconductivity can occur is if the Josen coupling between the planes is very weak. And a way to guess weak superconductivity is to impose this kind of stripy pattern of superconductivity, which is in fact even much more elaborate than what I showed on the previous picture, because here they suggested that superconducting order parameter changes sign as you go from one stripe to the other. And in such a way, the smallest non-zero Josen coupling will be between fourth nearest neighbors. So that's a way to get down to very small Josen couplings. So it seems to be not implausible. Okay, so now let's imagine that this is true, and let's see if we can calculate something sensible for the Nernst effect. And this is the cartoon that I have, so I have basically those superconducting.
I just want to go back and ask a dumb question. It's not about, this is not your work, but still I.
This one?
I've seen this picture a few times, but never.
Okay.
I really looked into it. So why is that evidence for 2D superconductivity? You know, so why is that normal to have a non-zero resistance below the? You want to associate the drop with the KT transition?
Yeah, pretty much. And, so what they see is that.
I thought you're supposed to have non-linear resistivity below the KT transition, but it's still zero linear response.
And you do get non-zero resistivity here, which would be consistent.
Right? I thought that in a real 2D film, what you get in principle is nonlinear IV, but with zero linear response resistivity.
Yeah, okay, so.
Is that what's actually observed here, or is it really the linear response?
No, so I think actually there are quite a bit of subtleties with measuring, even in real two-dimensional, or let's say very thin films, superconducting films, to measure KT transition has been extremely difficult,
right? But
for multiple reasons. So here the evidence for 2D superconductivity is that as you go below this transition, the ratio of rho AB to rho C really drops precipitously. Mm-hmm. So it's, I don't know, 10 to 4, 10 to 5, some crazy number.
Yeah. Okay. That was a part of the story I understood. So I didn't understand this.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't really have explanation why.
Supposed to be.
Yeah, I don't have any good. So probably they have a better explanation for why this might be sensible.
I mean, pick up on Leon's point. I mean, if they did an AC measurement, then you could sort of answer that question. But if they looked at an IV curve or biased stuff, I mean, I think it's really hard to know. But you're right. It's not the zero bias resistance.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, it would be. I should look at the later papers because they do have something afterwards, and maybe some of those questions are answered. So I'm going to look it up and I'm going to let you know. But okay, so it doesn't look improbable. So then, if we want to actually estimate how the Nernst should go under this kind of conditions, it's not that difficult. So the ingredients are the vortex density. So if we have magnetic fields, we can calculate how many vortices per unit area we have. It's going to be this. Then for the phase slip, we need to estimate what's the potential barrier is. And the way it works is that we'll have to destroy a superconductivity in the piece of this wire which has length xi. And here I assume that it has width a and height c. So that's the volume, that's the condensation energy, roughly. And you get that the condensation energy for the phase slip, given delta of something like 40, 50 millivolts, is not too crazy. It's like 25 kelvins times the ratio of xi to a, which is perhaps 4 or 5. So it can be maybe 100 kelvin. Okay, maybe more. I mean, and since it goes in exponential, it's actually significant. But this kind of number is notoriously difficult to estimate. Then for the tunneling rate, we can use the expression that Langer, McGarker, McCumber, and Halpern came up with. In fact, MH came up with, and it has to do with the Ginzburg-Landau scattering rate. And it's basically some temperature scale or energy scale comparable to the transition temperature. Okay, because so here the assumption is that the superconductivity can go really, in those superconducting stripes can be actually can be seeded at much higher temperatures, but then sort of the actual condensation would be happening at significantly lower temperatures. So this would be the rate of jumping, let's say, from one side to the other. But now the trick is that the temperature is different across the stripes. So therefore, it will be easier to jump from the hot region into the colder one than from colder to the hot. So what will enter in the voltage is the difference of the rates in the two opposite directions. Now, this is the number of vortices in the unit area of L times Xi. Okay, so and that's overall the voltage which will be generated across the region of width Xi. So and then if we just basically put those numbers, put them in, for the Nernst coefficient, which is the ratio of the electric field to the applied magnetic field to the gradient of temperature, we get the following type of expression, okay, which if we assume something like 100 Kelvin for delta F, it comes out to be that. And L here is the, again, interstripe distance, okay? So, and that's in nanovolts per Kelvin per Tesla. So this is the number which I left in the expansion because we don't really know it too well, and the result can really go up and down by quite a bit. So if we look at the experimental data, the typical energy scale, sorry, the typical scales for the Nernst are indeed on the order of maybe up to 1 microvolt per Kelvin. And from here, let's say if our L is equal to 4, then we get 16, we get 1,000 with some exponential factor, which is supposed to be small. We get something which is not totally crazy, actually, which seems to be fairly close to the experimental values. So I don't know, other theories for a Nernst effect, actually, there aren't too many. No matter what you do, you always end up with this number, I don't know. But at least if you do this kind of procedure, it does seem that you get the right order of magnitude, at least. But now, sort of at more high level, at more qualitative level, so what are we actually trying to achieve? What are we trying to explain? So, and for that, let's consider the differences between diamagnetism, Nernst, and optics. What's each one of those measurements is supposed to be sensitive to? So for diamagnetism, we know that it's enough just to have a basically totally insulating matrix with just superconducting grains, and that will be perfectly sufficient to have expulsion of the flux. Okay, so it's the least demanding one. Now for the Nernst, so what I try to argue is that you want to have, particularly if your volume fraction of superconductor is small, you want to have extended regions of superconductivity which are hard to avoid. So the heat actually has to cross them. So that really pushes us into the direction of stripy superconductivity, so it seems. Then as far as optics is concerned, that's where really I have the most trouble with, because optics definitely it's a Q equal to zero response. So we're really supposed to shake whole sample in various directions and see what is how the electron liquid responds kinematically. But clearly there has to be a length scale which is also embedded into all of that. However, it seems that nobody really understands what this length scale is. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if the optics, the reason that the optics drops precipitously is that even though, let's say, we have those stripy superconducting regions, the fact that they have certain extent is not sufficient for us to pick up something in the optics, unless this coherence length of those superconducting grains is sufficiently big. Okay. So let me tell you something more crackpotish, just for fun, and even more crackpotish. So let's say that we take this picture seriously. And we ask ourselves, what would happen if we really go towards optimal doping?
Your picture so far, it seems to be a really static stripes, even though
that's right.
Experimentally, with the rare exception, you know, 1/8 and so forth,
that's right.
Usually seem to be, if they exist, they seem to be fluctuating. You'd expect to see some frequency dependence there, but you haven't.
That's right. So, yeah, exactly. So at low dopings, I think it's reasonable because you do expect that the barriers for reorientation should be quite high, and so the quantum fluctuations should be not very effective in rearranging things. However, if you go to high dopings and the distances shrink, let's say at 12%, it's just four lattice constants, it wouldn't be so surprising if the quantum fluctuations could actually drive the transitions. And that's precisely the point of this slide. That's I'm just reusing the same cartoon, but you really, I hope that you use your imagination and you imagine something much more dramatically fluctuating. So this whole thing can become a soup of basically loops and lines which fluctuate, but according to the constraint, that's you always keep basically two thick lines and two thin lines connecting to the same node. And in fact, I mean, the model is not new, it's known as like a gauge magnet, and it supposedly has a wrong exact solution, which I never was able to find out why it's wrong, by Peter Arland. And in fact, a similar model also has been invoked by Volhard and company in order to understand various charge ordering phenomena in the spinless systems on the two-dimensional checkerboard lattices and also, I guess, in the particles. So the idea would be that indeed you can have this kind of fluctuations. And so then the interesting point about this is that if you look at it in this fancy animation again, that as the charges fluctuates, also the whole domain of antiferromagnetism changes from AF to minus AF. So in a sense, it has a little bit of RBB flavor to it as well. That's one antiferromagnet goes into minus antiferromagnet. So essentially, this kind of stripy fluctuations would immediately lead to disordering of the antiferromagnet. And in fact, maybe the patterns which puzzled us for quite some time, that have been seen already over and over again by Seamus Davison, collaborators, and others, which look much more checkerboard-like, perhaps they could correspond indeed to this kind of dynamically fluctuating pattern as opposed to things which are much more static. So the reason I'm saying that is that if you remember, when people try to sort of map it onto the stripy picture, it seems like you have basically this crisscross checkerboard at about, again, same 12%, and if you just calculate the total charge density, assuming that you have two stripy patterns overlaying each other, the charge density would be almost factor of two higher than you would nominally get from the other sort of canonical stripes, which have half hole per unit length, right, per copper. So, but if you imagine that really this is the reflection of a dynamic pattern, sort of reorientation pattern, which is happening, and then you're really seeing just basically half of the time you see this kind of pattern, and half of the time you see that kind of pattern. So the charge counting actually would work out. Okay. So anyway, so that's it. I think that's enough of weird stuff. So, but just to show you some of the curious pattern which I got by searching Google. So this is actually. That's more creative, in fact, natural realization of this stripy pattern that one can get with the same set of constraints that I told you about. And in fact, this is a thin film ferromagnets magnetized in the normal direction. And you get to this kind of, I mean, the competition between dipole-dipole in exchange leads to this kind of behavior. So this is the cuprates, that's the sandy stuff. And that's actually a simulation of reaction diffusion, which was used quite a bit by Alan Turing in the last years of his life. And just to remind you what he said, since I never really said anything about the origin of superconductivity, etc. So Turing, when he was praised on use application of reaction diffusion to morphogenesis, he said that the stripes are easy, but what about the horse part? And so same here. Superconductivity, I mean, that's a totally different question. Or maybe related, but maybe not. Okay, thank you.
If you have these fluctuating stripes, you pointed out early in the talk that there's a weak canting ferromagnetism associated with that. might you not expect to be able to see that characteristic frequency of fluctuation as a resonance phenomenon, coupled with magnetic oscillating magnetic field?
Well, I guess in reality, you're always going to have some kind of distribution. It's not going to be perfect. But maybe there is some sort of broad resonance that one could get. So you basically, you mean that just like with, if you think of this whole patch as a single moment, that you can sort of apply magnetic field, and then you can do sort of like NMR type of... might well be. So, I mean, the question is, yeah, so what would be manifestations? And, I mean, there's a bunch of NMR done already, so maybe, in fact, there is some signature of that. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, you could see regularities as a function of, doping or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is actually some theoretical analysis of stability of stripes as function of doping, because I agree if there is some magic number of x, 1/8, the stripes probably stable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but look, I don't know. I mean, there are, I guess, a couple of issues there. But so the experimental probes are definitely not ideal, right? I mean, we see what we see. But neutrons, they do indicate that there is a lot of incommensuration happening, and whether one should interpret it as something static and disordered or as something dynamic and fluctuating, I mean, that's a tough question. But if it does exist in a fairly broad range of dopings, either dynamically or statically, I mean, for me, that would be already interesting enough. Numerics, I don't know, numerics notoriously have been tricky, right? I mean, so the original works that were done on the subjects, just basically Hershey-Fock on Hubbard model by Zanon and company, have been disavowed even by their own creators, that they're too simplistic. But they do show us something, right? They do show us indication that maybe the system may want to create some... Yeah. Look, I mean, so I'm not particularly worried about the possibility of existence of stripes, because I know they happen, okay? So the question is whether they happen in this particular case. And it seems to me that some of the experimental data might have an interpretation within this picture. And probably because I'm not smart enough, I don't really see what are the alternatives, okay? And I think that the experimental data are fine. I mean, they're just puzzling, they're strange, but I don't think they're impossible.
So given this model from the starting part of your talk, would that also help you to tell us something about the neutron response? I mean, you have the size
That's right.
of objects, so you have their dynamics, so
yeah.
In principle
yeah.
you could push this further and claim that somehow you could say something about what the inelastic neutron should say.
Yeah, so inelastic, that's one thing, but also even at the elastic level, that's something which I didn't mention. So if you have, let's say, this kind of pattern, right, so you have, you know, AF, and minus AF everywhere else, and you just basically sum over all the area, you're going to find that there is an overall net AF, right? Which means that in the neutrons, you're going to see a pi-pi peak. So basically, at least one trivial prediction from this kind of consideration is that if you apply magnetic field to the system and you start, let's say, from the static incommensurate peaks, you should generate also a commensurate peak at pi-pi. So that's the most straightforward. Dynamics is obviously much more complicated. One would have to think how it works out. Thank you.